That's loud. Thank you, everybody, for being here. I appreciate the time and the attention. The topic for this session is the power of narrative. And a lot of times in life, when you look around at why people do what they do, many times there's sort of a multiple levels of how people act and why they act. And what I'm going to try to do just in the few minutes that I have everybody here is try to put forth an idea that many times what's driving behavior, and if you're a parent or a grandparent or a teacher or an educator, or you're just giving lectures, what's driving behavior many times is not at the surface, but it's what's behind the surface. So a whole bunch of years ago, I was speaking somewhere, it was for Pesach, and there was something that was bothering me, and I'm constantly bothered by this idea of Pesach Seder. There's something incredible about the fact that we have a mitzvah to talk, which is Jews is like perfect for us. You know what I'm saying? Like, we seem to nail that mitzvah all the time, but one night a year, we have it on Seder, and it's hard for us because it's in between food, so we don't like doing it, but you know, if we could talk any at the same time, it'd be amazing. But the idea that we have this mitzvah, Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim, and there's a concept that even if no one's in this room, but just that's asking questions and telling over the story that we've known a million times, why do we have this for? And it took me a while to get my answer, and I got it in the most unusual place, which is obvious for those who live in Israel. I got it from an Israeli cab driver, because Israeli taxi drivers are the greatest people in the world, right? They're politicians, and they're commandos, and they're, you know, they're philosophers, and it's all for triple the fare to go four blocks in Israel. That's the low, low price. So one time I was behind in a cab, and I see a guy, and he sees me, and right away I can say, like, in my American accent, he's like, yes, I'll make some money today. And he goes through his spiel. And his spiel included his life story, and what life was like in Israel before I was even born, and what it was like, and it was awesome. And it's really awesome, because Israeli cab drivers are really awesome. So he's telling me some story about what it was like when you grew up in some part of Yerushalayim, and there was a time where they didn't have food or water, and it was incredible. As a guy who grew up in the modern world, I never saw a time, Baruch Hashem, that my grandparents lived. And I didn't even know of it even in America, that Israel, there were moments in Israel that Mamish had nothing. So there was at one point in the conversation, he was telling me about a story where he was in the army, and the whole world is against him. And I asked him, did you ever have a moment where you thought it would be over? Like, did it ever dawn on you that, like, there would be no Israel? Like, did it ever, like, have a second, like, we tried, we did the best we could, they're going to wipe us out, they're all going to come in, the invasions are going to work, and the Arabs are going to basically kick us out or kill us, and then we'll have to go move back to Europe or to Russia or to America. Did it ever dawn on you that the whole will drive you to the sea could actually happen? And he said, never. I'm like, how? He says, listen, I'm a Chiloni. Meanwhile, he's not a Chiloni, right? He's a Sfardi Chiloni. The Sfardi Chiloni, there's no such thing as a Sfardi Chiloni. You know what I'm talking about? Like, he could be driving to the beach on Shabbos. You say one word about God, he'll punch you in the face and kick you out of the cab. Like, there's no such concept as, like, it's fighting for the army, being a Chiloni. It doesn't exist in real. He's not really a Chiloni, but he thinks he is. He goes, I'm a Chiloni. He goes, I grew up with no Torah. There were 2 days a year, my grandfather, my father said to me, you can't miss. One day is Yom Kippur, and the second day is Pesach Seder. You don't, those 2 days you don't mess with. Because you don't mess with God's existence. He's a Yesh Borei Olam. There's a God in this world. Yom Kippur, you show up, you give respect. And you never miss Pesach Seder. And he goes, and I didn't follow much about the Seder because I was able to follow the Hebrew clearly. He goes, but I learned one thing. I learned that God took us out of Egypt in the worst of situations and he brought us to Israel. And I thought to myself, if we were down before and God saved us once, he'll save us again. We're never going to die. So it never dawned on me for one second in the bunkers, in the foxhole with no water, that it would ever end with me. And I was so taken by that. Because nobody taught the guy. No one explained to him the idea of the eternity of the Jewish people. He didn't have all of the prophecies of the Nevi'im. Nobody looked at him and showed him statistics or anything like that. He's sitting in a bunker, and all he's using as his inspiration that we're going to keep on going, what gets him going through that war, what gets him going by carrying the pail of water, is a story that was told thousands of years ago. Why would that impact his behavior? Why would that change his resilience? because it happened to his great-great-great-great-grandparents? And the answer is because the way we live our lives is through story. What we're doing constantly is we're using story in order to navigate every single day of our lives. And the story of the Pesach Seder is the story of our Eretz Yisrael and Am Yisrael, and that's what gave him chizik. That was the speech. There was a wonderful lady in the crowd named Razi Chechik. She's an educator, she's phenomenal, she's wonderful. She was sitting in the crowd. On her, as the Kodesh Baruch Hu runs the world, was an article from the New York Times. I still have it. 2013. Written by a guy named Bruce Feeler. If you want it, charlie@charlierard.com, I'll email it to you. She says to me, I'm holding this article the whole yontif. I'm holding it for you. She hands me the article. And the article's titled, The Stories That Bind Us, and it was profiling the research by a man named Marshall Duke. Marshall Duke is a psychologist from Emory. And his thesis, his whole area is about families. Why some make it, why some dissipate, why families break up. That's what he was doing. And he's talking about his research to his wife, Sarah. And his wife, Sarah, says to him something amazing. She goes, you know, what she did for a living is she was an expert in learning disabilities. And what she says is, you know what's so interesting? The kids that have the resilience to overcome challenge, I noticed they all know their family history. Like, these kids know about their grandmother, they know where they came from, they know about their parents. There's a certain interesting fact that I just seem to observe, that when a kid overcomes challenge, in my world, I notice that in their overcoming challenge, they seem to have a very good sense of where their family is from. And of course, this guy's going, light bulb. And he jumps into new research. And he takes his partner's name is Robin Fivish. And together they create this research to figure out what is it about this family story that leads to resilience. And they created this questionnaire called Do You Know? And they gave it out to students. And the students had to answer it. Do you know where your grandmother's from? Do you know where your grandfather grew up? Do you know where your parents are from? Do you know about your family history? And what they found blew them away. That for many of the children, the most resilient, the most able to overcome challenge, the most able to be in control of situations that are out of control, what the factor that was most determinative of what made them who they were was not their capacity today, it was their knowledge of their family past. Now, how could that be? So just this research came out in 2001, the summer. What happened in the fall of 2001? 9/11. And they, after the aftermath sort of quieted down, they went out and they did a whole new study to the kids, 2001, 9/11, about their ability to overcome the challenges. 9/11, what they found was almost the same exact thing. But here's what they came up with. Listen to this research. It's incredible. That family, and that's what we're going to unpack just for the few minutes I have here. We're like packed in here. I want to unpack why family histories could determine futures depending on the family history and what's going on behind the scenes of the details of a story and how that changes your life. They found that there's three types of family narratives. When you have a family history, you don't know your family facts. When someone knows about their family, when you ask a child, tell me about your grandmother or your grandfather, they don't recite chapter and verse. She was 8, she bought apples, she was 9, she was living in this town in Resalvia, she was 15, they moved to Munkach, then the Holocaust. They don't know the timeline. What they know about their family is stories. I know my grandmother came from here, and I remember this story, and my grandfather told me this story, and my mother comes from here. And you know where we come from? We come from this town. Do you know where my great-great-great-grandfather, you know that we were the Ben-Achar? What people know is not the family facts. What they know is the family narrative. They know the family stories. And all stories Duke came up with falls into one of three categories. One is called the ascending story. We came from little and we grew and raised. We had nothing. We came to this country and your grandfather worked 40 hours a day and he put everybody through school and then the market turned and now look at what's happened to us. Then there's the descending family history. We used to have everything, and then all of a sudden the Depression came. Before the war, we owned the largest store in all of Europe, and then we got hit by the war, and we couldn't even, to this day, we still can't get over it. And those two stories have ups and downs. But there's one family narrative that trumps them all. It's called the oscillating story. And the oscillating story is, we had ups, we were once amazing, and everything was going great, and then this would happen to us, and we got hit in Europe, and then we came to America, we couldn't put anything together, but then we kept on working, and we had ups, and we had downs, and we had ups, and your grandfather was like this, and your grandma was like this, and your uncle and your aunt. The family rose, the family fall. The family rose, the family fell. And when that narrative is told over in a way where the kids look back and see the ups and the downs, what that creates is resiliency in the next generation. Now the question for us is why? And how do we change it for our, if we're lucky enough to have children or students or friends, how do we change it? Because what's happening is they're being shaped now. And the answer is, you have to understand the following theory. Our brains are very limited machines. It could do anything. The Kodesh Baruch Hu gave us a brain that is unbelievable, but the brain's number one function is to survive. That is the base of the Kodesh Baruch Hu gives us is survival. Greatness is an option. Survival is a gift. So everything you have in your mind right now, the Kodesh Baruch Hu gives you, is to survive. In order to survive, your brain has to control what it takes in. So right now, if I walk into a supermarket, right? Anyone who's raising a kid with sensory processing disorder, you know what I'm talking about. When we walk into a supermarket, our brains only take in a fraction of the stimuli that's in front of us. We don't hear much. We go to the supermarket, we have our list, and we're walking around getting our stuff. You hold a kid with sensory processing disorder, that means he takes in too much stimuli, he hears everything, right? He hears the squeaky cart two aisles over. He hears the dropped cereal box an aisle back. He hears that passive-aggressive husband who's telling his wife, there is no oregano. Oh, here's oregano. I'll be home in 15 minutes, right? He hears all of it. And because he hears all of it, he basically melts down. Because you can't possibly process all that stimuli in any given second. So one of the greatest things that the Kodesh Baruch Hu gives us in order to survive is something called a schema. A schema is like a filter. It's like what we place in a way, it's not place, but it's over our minds. And as you go into the world, what happens is you live in this world, and most of what happens in front of you, you never see. You never catch all the cars that drive past you as you're driving here, because if it's not relevant or it's not going to hurt you, your brain can't process it, because if you're going to process every car, you couldn't drive. And when you walk into a room, you can't process every nuance and every look. The husbands can process what their wife is thinking for sure, but nobody else can, because it's not about survival. But for the husband, it is about survival, so it's totally different. You can't process life, because if you do, everything's going to totally knock you down. So what you have in your mind that you're seeing every single moment is a very small slice of reality. That's why frum Jews, so to speak, can pick out frum Jews a mile away. We pick out things that are invisible to the rest of the world. We know exactly. You ever go on an airplane and you know, like, you're from Pat, I know you're from, you know what I'm saying? You can catch frum people from distances. How can we do that for? It's because when you live around Jews long enough, your mind gets sensitive to the nuances of how you walk and talk and the things that you're having and how you wear your hat and what you wear to a Yankee game, even though no one wears it except for you, because who wears, like, you know, a nice blue shirt and slacks to a Yankee game? You pick up all these little nuances until you realize, oh yeah, where are you from? The way we operate in this world is that we have a filter. And what happens to us our whole lives is that filter shapes. And that filter shapes and shapes and shapes. And then when you go out into the world, you're not looking at the actual world. You're looking at the world through the filter. That's why when you watch a game, you'll see two different people having two totally different physical responses to the same exact game. How is it possible? It's the same moment in reality. How come this person's cheering, this person's crying, and the person in the back has no idea what you're talking about? Because they're not actually looking at the game. They're looking at the game through the prism of the filter that they grew up in. And so if you grew up in New York, they tell you, these guys, that's your guys. That's your team. Those are your colors. And you go through enough times and you're thinking, watch a game. You don't even think it's them anymore. You think it's yourself. That's why if you've ever been to a game, you'll see that, like, you know, you go, like, you look at the stands, you see a guy, like, you know, in the bleachers with, like, a pot belly and a beer going, like, we're number one. You're looking like, you're for sure not number one. You know what I'm saying? Maybe the guy's on the ground the number one, but you're not even close, right? How come he thinks he's number one? The answer is because you spend enough time looking at the same exact people and the same exact jersey colors. Over time, your filter says, that's me. When you look out in the world, You're not actually looking at the world. You're looking at a very small perspective and a very small perception of the world that's being colored by what you know already to be true or right. You don't walk into Eretz Yisrael and you're like, well, I hope it works out or not, it'll be okay. You're already invested. Your family, the people around you. When you look at everything that's going on, so much that's already driving the way you feel is how you've already felt about it before. Which is why two people get into a fight and they're still fighting the whole time. They're not even listening to each other. They're just waiting for the person to stop speaking. It's because they both have a different perspective of the same situation. Well, then what drives perspective? Well, one of the greatest things that drive perspective is narrative. Because one other thing that we have that's limited is our memory. We don't remember the past so well. It's actually a gift called shichacha that we have. Because if we remembered everything in the past, how could you function in the future? How could you get over challenge? So how do we draw back the memory? So our memory looks for something to attach to. There has to be something for the detail in our past to attach to in order for us to remember it. You know what it attaches to? It attaches to narrative. The stories we tell ourselves about ourselves are the stories that we remember, and those are the stories that we're actually seeing in front of us every single day. And so what we're looking at is not reality. What we're looking at is the story. How the story plays out in front of us. So when someone grows up in a family and they're trying to find their identity, and the family story is, we've gone through challenge and we will make it, and that person sitting in eighth grade and they can't get through math, or they're sitting on a foul line and they're scared that if they miss the shot, everyone's going to hate them. All they have to draw on in their past, or all they have to see in the future, how is this going to play out? What stimuli can I turn to look at subconsciously to see how to navigate? What they're doing is saying, I've been hearing a story my whole life about overcoming challenge, and whether it's subconscious or not, they're attaching themselves the details of my grandmother or my parents or my friend that overcame challenge. And as I see something that's stopping me, what I am doing at a much lower level than conscious is I am saying, well, I've seen this before. There's a difference. The facts are different, but we've been here before. You hit a wall and you keep on going. But if I hear a story of your father used to be, and then the whole thing took away. You know what happened back then? Yeah, he had this, and then they took it away from him. That's what the rabbis do. You know, that's what these guys do. What am I going to tell you? What am I going to tell you? That's what happens. And that kid comes up against the wall. The story playing in his head is, as soon as you get hit, you're never going to pick up again. And so the family narrative is actually replaying itself in the children. Because the details change. But as the kids get the narrative the first time, you know what they do for the rest of their lives? They look for the stimuli that's going to align closer to the narrative they feel most comfortable with. So if they've always heard the narrative of failure, and you look at a world in front of you where you have stimuli that could be you can make it and you can't make it, you can't choose both, your brain can't take it all in. So you know what stimuli you automatically go to? The stimuli that says you're not going to make it. But if you've been hearing stories about you're going to make it, we're going to make it, we're going to make it, and you look at the same set of stimuli and you can't choose them all, you're going to look at a stimuli that's going to tell you, I know it's hard, but you know what? It's been hard before, we can get through this. The reason why that guy in the cab sitting in a bunker saying we're going to make it is because you know what God did in the brilliance of the Rabbona Shalom? You think Pesach Seder is to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim? You're joking me? With the Jews, we all got A's on the tests. If the goal was to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, you know, he would put it in a classroom and then make a contest over it, and then we'd beat each other up and like be proud of the fact that we got a trophy for Torah learning. He didn't do that. God's like, got it. I know you know the story. Here's what we're going to do. You know who's telling you the story? Your family. You know how many times you're going to hear it? Your whole life. At the same day. With all this different stimuli. It's going to be an educational... This is going to be an educational smorgasbord, sensory with matzahs and everything you can ask for, all centered around one story. You know what the story is? You were in the guts. You were in the pits. And I came myself, lo ayadei malach, lo ayadei shaliach. I pulled you out. Because you know why I pulled you out? Because you're my nation. And it's going to happen to you again. But hold over the door. I'm going to take care of you. You know why Kodesh Baruch Hu did that for us? Not so that we know about Yitzias Mitzrayim. We know about Yitzias Mitzrayim. Because how else are we going to get through Galus? What are they going to use in Europe? What are they going to use in the pogroms of when they kick you out of Spain? What are the Jews going to do at night? When you're sitting in a bunker in Eretz Yisrael, when you're going through the entire set of history, what are the Jews going to do? What are they going to tell themselves? We've been losing for 1,000 years. It's 1498. The Jews that stayed in Spain and converted to Christianity are now all lining up to get through the Inquisition. Do you think we have a shot at winning this? There's no way we're going to win. It's 1505. It's 1550. It's 1592. It's 100 years of getting beaten up. We're going to win now? Who says we're going to win ever again? Why can't you be Jewish anymore? You know why I'd be Jewish for? Because you sit down in the room and God goes, whoa, 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 whoa. Remember this narrative? We win. We win. We'll be there for you. We win. And you look out and you see things like Mashiach. We're going to make it. You know, I had a guy on a radio show once. I don't know how much time I have. I think I'm almost done already. Holy cow. I think I have 5 minutes. I have a guy on a radio. Someone just tell me when it's 12:30, okay? I have a guy on my radio show once. He's a Hollywood writer. He said to me, you know what? No one realizes. He goes, you know what the Jews did for Hollywood? Not that they made films. You know what they did? It's an incredible thing. Go look at the research. He says, the Jews brought a storyline to Hollywood. Before the Jews came to Hollywood, there weren't the storylines of, you think you're going to win, you're down in the pits, and then you win at the end. The whole narrative is before Joseph Campbell, for those who read that book. The whole narrative of the Rocky IV and Miracle and every single movie of the guy, the hero that goes down and picks up. That's the Jewish story, he says. That just plays out in different details. Every time you see it, that's our narrative. When we live in the world, you have to ask yourself the following question. What narrative am I teaching other people? My actions are providing a narrative for my family. I had a father come to me once, shocked that his kid wasn't into Judaism. I'm not blaming the dad. I'm trying to figure out. So I said to him, tell me about your day. Great guy, he's wonderful. It's not his fault. Tell me about your day. I daven 3 times a day. I go to Daf Yomi. I give tzedakah. Kid doesn't care. I said, how many times does your kid see you do any of these things? He goes, never. I wake up in the morning, I go daven. I daven in the city, I come back tomorrow if I'm here. I daven here, I'm like, when does your child ever see you? He goes, he sees me nights and on Sundays. I go, what do you do on Sundays? I'm like, I watch football. I go, what happens when you're in front of the football game? He goes, I'm a huge Giant fan, I'm going out of my mind. I'm like, just ask yourself, your son is building a narrative on his dad. What, in your son's perspective, is the most important thing to his dad? I know it's Judaism. Your son's narrative. Because it's football. Because when I'm in front of a game, I'm going out of my mind. I said, so in your son's mind, the narrative that you're building is, Judaism is on the way to a football game. So why do you blame him? He's a kid. Every one of us, every day of our lives, is building a narrative to those that are around us. You want your kids to be good in school, and they bring a 90. Where's my 10 points? Mom says, well, I'm just trying to get my kid pumped to get my 100. What's that narrative of where's my 10 points? Forget the detail. Go one step deeper. What's the narrative? You're not enough. You're not enough. I get it. We're all Jewish. We all got to be great at academics. You're not enough. And if I can't figure out how to inspire you to get to the 100, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to top down make you feel guilty that you don't get 100. The narrative is, you know how people I meet every single day who are incredible and they're always worried they're not making in life? It's because someone in their lives, teachers, parents, just thought that the way to inspire them is to remind them always, you're not enough. Throughout the way we do it in our details. When your sister was your age, you know what your father accomplished? It's good, bud. And maybe you'll be a doctor one day. The narrative is, you're not enough. The narrative that we're telling our families, you hear some of the stories that we hear, even in the Jewish people, we tell stories to each other. Some of the stories, the narrative is, if you do Torah mitzvahs, God gives you goodies. And if you don't do Torah mitzvahs, God doesn't give you goodies. Think about that for a kid living in the world of Hester Punim. And whether the kid goes through his life and goes, I'm doing Torah mitzvahs, like, where's my stuff? I don't know why. We look at our kids and they think like we're living in Amazon.gov. I don't understand. I order 3 tefillahs and I wear skirts and I eat kosher food. Like, how come I'm not married yet? Crisis of faith. Because every single story they've always heard was a story with the guy did a mitzvah and tied his shoes properly and the missile went over his head and killed the rest of the soldiers and he survived. It's exciting. What does that narrative say? What it means to inspire people is to look past the details. Because details come and details go. What it means to inspire people is to recognize that what you're really doing, if you're in front of somebody, child, student, anybody, is you are actually playing out a narrative in front of them. You are playing out a play called life. And they are learning from you the details of life. How does mom deal with challenge? She's so sweet, and then she gets into a little traffic, and she turns into psycho. Because that's how you deal with challenge. My father didn't give her a birthday present that was expensive enough, and it was a fight for a week. The narrative of me, every second of our lives, what's happening is, we are in the game of narrative. And when you recognize that the most powerful mechanism of change happens when you take control not of the detail but of the narrative, then you start acting and saying and commentating on life in a way that allows those around you to create an oscillating narrative. We go up, we go down, we try hard, we keep on moving, but at the end of the day, whatever your narrative is, my narrative is that Hashem loves you no matter what. You keep on trying. You can make your own narrative up. But if you have the opportunity to influence somebody, and you operate on the level of narrative, and you're mindful of the story that is being told beneath the scenes and the details, you'll be able to give somebody a schema, a perspective that may last years after you see them. Thank you so much.